Welcome to This Song, the podcast where artists talk about the songs that changed their lives. I'm your host, Elizabeth McQueen, and in this episode, we'll be talking first to singer and songwriter and multi-instrumentalist Zach Little from the band St. Seneca, and then to James, Abe, and Sam from the band Sons of Bill. And usually, at this point, I would try to draw some overarching theme that we'll be exploring during this episode, but really, this time, there is no meta theme. The songs people chose and the reasons that they chose them, they're all pretty different, which is its own kind of delight. And speaking of songs, we do have a Spotify playlist that contains all the songs from this episode. You'll find it on the This Song page, because we never actually play full songs in this podcast. We only play clips, but we want to have a place for you to go to listen to any or all of the songs all the way through. And that's what the playlist is for. Let's get started with Zach Little from the band St. Seneca. They're a band from Columbus, Ohio, and we here at KTX, the radio station in Austin, Texas, where we make this podcast, we're fans. We dug the record they put out in 2015 called Such Things, and when they came to town, we were psyched to have them perform a set in Studio 1A. Studio 1A is our gorgeous studio where bands can come and play, and really, it's almost more like a venue than a studio. It's got a great PA system and good monitors so that bands don't have to play with headphones on. And it's got these gigantic windows and space for like 70 people to sit and watch. Anyway, we love Studio 1A. And like I said, we were totally excited for St. Seneca to come and play there. After they were done, Jackie Fuller sat down with Zach and he told her about a song that showed him at a very young age, actually, what he wanted to do with music. So here he is, Zach Little.
I think I would have to say that song that really ignited things for me in some ways is Uncle Albert on Ram by Paul McCartney.
We're so sorry. So sorry if we caused you any pain. We're so sorry.
I feel like it was a song that I heard when I was really young. I was just riding in the car or something, and it came on the radio, which is kind of an odd song to hear on the radio because it's so long and like has this bizarre sort of like linear arrangement. But I had never heard anything remotely like that, and I feel like it just kind of blew my mind. I had no idea what it was. And then later I thought it was like a Beatles song. So when I was older, I remember like looking for that song in particular, like searching like endlessly, like being like, well, which Beatles record is this song on? And then, you know, later found out that it was like from the solo record. But yeah, I just feel like it kind of opened my mind up to that idea of producing a song in that way, that it's almost this whole like self-contained little universe. It's full of like surprises and twists and turns. Yeah, that was a pretty big one for me.
And do you still go back to it?
Oh yeah, I think that record's amazing. The whole record is amazing, and like that point, I feel like it's just like the apex of the whole thing.
And that to me feels like a song that most people know but don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what it specifically is it about that song that captured you? That you think maybe other people might take for granted, right? Because wouldn't you agree? It's like, oh yeah, everybody knows Uncle Albert, but it's, I can recall it in my head, but I can't.
Right,
you know?
Right. Well, it's got like the hook part at the end, the, like heads across the water, heads mm-hmm. across the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Heads across the water, heads across the sky.
But it's just like, you're already so enraptured with the song by that point, because it's got like the weird little kind of like psychedelic passages.
We're so sorry, but we haven't heard a thing all day. We're so sorry.
There's like the spoken word thing.
We're so sorry. But we haven't.
And then the horns. And then, like, at the end, it just, like, hits you with this, like, huge hook. And they just, like, repeat it over and over and over again. So I don't know. I guess it just kind of, like, implanted itself in my head.
Did your folks listen to a lot of music?
No. Well, I think that that might have been part of it, too, is that, you know, I was definitely grew up with, like, music around, but I didn't have the kind of parents that were, like, listening to, like, the Grateful Dead all the time or something mm-hmm. like that. It mm-hmm. was, like, pop country, just radio country music all the time and that kind of stuff. So then to hear something like that, like, on probably the oldies, like, radio station was that much more radical. I was probably somewhere in the neighborhood between, like, 4 and 7
oh, wow.
when
okay.
I heard the song.
Were you into music as a little kid, or did
yeah.
that kind of open the floodgates for you?
No, I was, I always, like, I feel like I kind of had the impulse to write songs uh-huh. and I sung songs and, like, made up songs when I was a little kid all the time, from the time that I can remember it, four or six years old or something.
I feel like I can definitely see in your songwriting that idea of a universe encapsulated within the few minutes of a song. Do you feel like Uncle Albert has sort of had a direct trajectory towards what you're doing now?
I think so. Yeah, I think that that's totally, totally fair. Mm-hmm. I feel like those points are fundamental mm-hmm. to where I'm coming from with, like, music. To the extent I even feel like maybe, like, within a single note, you know, there's a universe. I think that if you were to compress all the songs ever made into, like, a single note.
That's aspirational.
I think it's there.
Yeah. Did you ever try to play Uncle Albert? Have you ever played it?
No. That would be ambitious. That would be ambitious.
Yeah.
I don't know. It is a song that's produced as a recording, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's no pretense to ever performing that thing live or whatever. It's like they made that thing to listen to as that recording or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe Paul McCartney plays it live. But it's one of those things where it's kind of embracing that, like, form mm-hmm. and that format, like, making it, like, this special moment with these textures and sounds. And I think that that's the exciting thing about making recordings, you know, is to kind of cast off the pretense of it being this live thing mm-hmm. and to build something that exists on its own terms. And I feel like that song and songs like that are a big inspiration for me.
Admiral Hall said, notified me. He had to have a bath or he couldn't get to sea. I had another look and I had a cup of tea and a butter pie.
Butter pie?
The butter wouldn't melt, so put it in the pie.
All right.
How does that translate for you when you're performing live, like this idea of a recorded piece of music and a live piece of music getting to be their own thing? How do you navigate that when you're playing songs that you've recorded and play live?
It goes both ways. I think it's, like, about addressing the specific song. You know what I mean? Like, uh-huh. some work well literally. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? It sounds cool to record it and let it be these people in a room creating these sounds and to try to, in whatever way that you can, document that. But then I like that you can create that world. Like, you know, like, you can make it sound like these people are in this room, but then all of a sudden it has, like, some surreal, like, dream twist sound that couldn't happen live. You know, that's what's so exciting about that. And then the flip side is that when you do those things, when you extend yourself like that in the studio, you're like, oh, how do we play this, you know? Mm. And that poses a whole other, like, series of, like, challenges. It's just like, well, what if we, you know, like, run it through this modulated delay and this thing or the synth or whatever to kind of conjure up that idea of that moment, of that sound. And then I think there are a lot of things you learn from that process that you then take back into the studio next time. It's just like we learned how to create this sound live based on some abstract sound we made recording. And then we take that into the studio and it just kind of has that feedback loop.
Sometimes you can't recreate the magic, and that's okay.
I think that you never can. I think that, like, playing a song, it's literally infinite. You know what I mean? I think that there's, like, an infinite spectrum. It's like you're never going to be able to, like, play a song the way that you played it that one time uh-huh. ever again. Uh-huh. And so I think that that's an exciting thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's something to kind of celebrate, like that imminence, like that liveliness of just like being in a place and offering something. And to not necessarily worry about, like, does this adhere to my expectations or people's expectations, mm-hmm. but to kind of celebrate the fact that it has its own life and mm-hmm. it's going to exist each time you do it.
Shout at the circulating clouds, blue and refiring themselves out on the house.
And below me, you can hear rare form from St. Seneca's record, Such Things. And we actually captured a lot of great videos from Studio 1A, so I will post links to those on the This Song page for this episode. And I loved where the conversation went, from hearing a song as a kid to talking about the infinite possibilities that a single note or a single song holds. Yes, please, more of that, please. Also, I was not personally aware of Uncle Albert. It made me realize how not well-versed I am in Paul McCartney's solo work and made me want to explore that work more. It's exciting. It's like I just found out a cool town existed that I get to go check out. So thanks, Zach. I want to take a quick break and ask that if you enjoyed that conversation with Zach Little, then please head to iTunes and subscribe to This Song. That way you'll get next week's episode with the members of Black Pistol Fire and Aaron and Chip Adams, who run the record label Modern Outsider, delivered right to you. You can also peruse our archive and listen to folks like Ian Astbury of The Cult or Glenn Hansard talk about life-changing songs. And while you're there, we'd really love it if you would take a second and leave a rating or a review. Ratings help us so much. They not only let us know how we're doing, but they also help people find us in the vast landscape of iTunes. And seriously, all of us on the This Song team, we want as many people as possible to hear these stories. Next up, we have James, Abe, and Sam Wilson from the band Sons of Bill. And yes, they all share the same last name because they're brothers. And yes, their dad's name is Bill. They are quite literally sons of Bill. They've been making music together as a band since 2006, and their sound has evolved from straight-ahead Americana to, I mean, my first instinct is to call it metaphysical American music. Their 2014 record Love and Logic is lush and psychedelic while remaining rooted in very American traditions. They came to the Austin City Limits Music Festival last year and came to the KUTX tent to do some live acoustic performances. And afterwards, they sat down with me, all three of them, to tell me about songs that blew their minds wide open. You'll hear James first, and then Abe, and then Sam. So here they are, Sons of Bill.
As we got older, you know, all of us got into kind of started different rock bands, but my dad was a musician, and at a really early age, he used to play Woody Guthrie's The Sinking of the Reuben James.
Tell me what was their names, tell me what was their names. You have a friend on that good Reuben James. What was their names, tell me what was their names. You have a friend on that good Reuben James.
And it used to always make my granddad cry, and so hearing my dad play that song sort of really helped me at a really young age kind of figure out what makes a song not just pleasurable or great, but like really important. And,
right.
And Woody Guthrie was always, you know, how all these songs have lasted throughout the years and in a really amazing way. And so that, for some reason, that song just always sticks out, and I always get a little choked up every time I play it.
Well, 100 men went down in that dark, watery grave. When that good ship went down, only 44 were saved. It was the last day of October, we saved the 44 from the cold ocean waters of that cold Iceland shore.
My dad used to play really early in the morning. He'd get up before all of us, and he'd just play. That was his time to himself. So depending on which one of us couldn't sleep, we'd kind of just waddle downstairs and hear him playing. I waddled. I don't know what you all did, but it was. I mean, I must have been 3 or 4 years old, but you know, all the songs my dad's played, all the good guy always died at the end, and I think that kind of had a dramatic effect on
my
young psyche.
So you had a sense of like that a song can make you feel like loss and sadness and kind of this like cathartic release at like a very young age.
Exactly, and tragedy,
like.
and you know what makes a song tragic and beautiful and worth singing and worth passing on. So. You know, even though we all got into metal and different, you know, hardcore and different things later, that kind of stuck, so.
Was that something that, so you went off and formed and got into, like, metal, did you
yeah,
say?
Yeah, for a few years.
Cool. And then when you decided to come back to Virginia, start a band with your brothers, is that kind of where you went, like, back to Woody Guthrie, back to...
Certainly, I mean, certainly in certain ways, you know, I mean, you always want to make time with music. You don't want to just have to... feel the pressure to be this or that genre. So we kind of, and that was the cool thing about forming with brothers, is we all kind of had each other's musical, went on that journey together. So we knew where each other was coming from. So we could play music very unconceptually, you know?
Yeah, you could kind of take a little
Iron Maiden moments within Woody Guthrie songs, and it all makes sense.
Now our mighty battleships will steam the bounding main, and the name of that good Reuben James. Tell me what was their names. Tell me what was their names.
Did you want to kind of get into it? Because in metal, I mean, I guess there's a certain amount of like catharsis through aggression, maybe in metal.
Yeah.
But like not exactly like tapping in, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but like tapping into like sadness.
Well, yeah, and why we liked metal is because James and I were really into metal, and Abe just by proxy, you know, he heard it. So
I'm not going to say anything.
But it's kind of the ultimate form of expression with music, just because you get like the intensity, then you get like the virtuosity, then you get like, you know, the sadness and the aggression, like you said, and the darkness. It's just, and then you get the virtuosity of like the players and singers. So that's like one. It just kind of was all encompassing for us at a young age. So
yeah, I guess there is a certain amount of like. Tragicness
and just intensity, you know, intensity, you know, whether it's a folk song or it's a metal song or a country song, we've always been drawn to intense music, you know, and uncompromisingly intense music.
So
I think you can find that no matter what kind of music you play.
So now Eighth.
Yes, thank you for asking.
Yes.
I'd have to say John Prine's Late John Garfield Blues.
Midnight fell on Franklin Street, and the lamppost balls were broke. For the life of me, I could not see, but I heard brand new Joe.
I still don't really know what it means, and I'm not sure that John really knows what it means, you know? But it just taught me that that's okay, that just following your instincts when you're writing a song, and if it affects you in an emotional way, even if you don't really know what it's about entirely, that following, as long as you're following your instincts and it means something to you, it will mean something to someone else out there. And he's just that kind of writer that he just didn't really care about what anyone thought about his songwriting. He would make people laugh and play a stupid song, and he'd play the most horribly heartbreaking song right afterwards.
Right.
So that really taught me a lot just about songwriting.
Old man sleeps with his conscience at night. Young kid sleeps with his dream. While a mentally ill sit perfectly still and live through life's in between.
So are you a lyricist? Do you write a lot of...
I do, yes.
Do you write a lot of lyrics? Mm-hmm. So for you, I mean, do you remember how old you were when you heard that song?
You know,
or was that another...
I was kind of... I came around to... I mean, I knew a lot of his hits when I was younger, but
yeah.
I came around to his deeper cuts later on, so that was more... I guess after college, really, I really got into his deeper cuts.
Had you been writing music before?
No, I was a late bloomer songwriting wise. I wrote my first song when I was 25, So,
really?
Yeah, yeah. I when we started the band, I was just the piano player, harmony singer. So it's still something I'm trying to figure out every day. And, you know, I feel like hopefully every songwriter is trying to still search every day, because otherwise it, you know, you get into a rut and you...
Otherwise, what's the point,
there's no
really?
Reason to do it anymore.
The horses scream, the nightmares dream, and the dead men all wear shoes, 'cause everybody's dancing, those late John guys feel blue.
So hearing that song, though, it sounds like it freed you in a way from, like, it has to be narrative, it has to be understandable, like, there is kind of a beyond words.
Exactly. And I still, you know, I write narrative songs and he wrote narrative songs, but it just, it doesn't have to be any sort of format. As long as it means something to you, there's probably someone out there that's going to feel that.
So when you're writing, do you sometimes, like, a lyric will come to you and you'll be like, I don't really understand you.
Oh, yeah.
But we are going to keep it. And
those are the best ones. The ones that drop out of the sky and you're like, I have no idea what that means, but I really like saying it.
It's like a gift, too.
Yeah,
sometimes it's like, oh, I was gifted this.
My favorite songs that I wrote, it's almost like I didn't write them. It's like I kind of forgot the whole process.
And like you tapped into something and it kind of came through.
Exactly.
Awesome.
The crappy ones I all remember.
That's a good, like benchmark. Like, the less I remember writing the song,
exactly,
the better the song is. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and Sam.
You know, I changed my mind at the last minute. I was going to say, I'm going to say it anyway, Waltz for Debbie by the Bill Evans Trio. It was recorded live at the Village Vanguard, just this small dive jazz bar, and it's one of the most magical records, I think, and it was recorded, I think, a week before Scott LaFaro, the bass player, died, and I think it's just one of the best trios in jazz of all time, and it's just, it's open, and it's just, you know, it's based on a standard. This song's called My Foolish Heart, but it's played instrumentally, and it's just one of my favorite tracks of all time, not just in jazz, but just music. Just had a magic with phrasing and chords, and the way that he played and interacted with the drummer. It wasn't just like how you'd normally think of, like, a cocktail jazz band just, you know, playing sort of cocktail jazz. It was very, very, very intense, very slow, very brooding, but really beautiful. And it was just one of the most magical trios in all of jazz history. And every time, I probably listened to it 300 times, and I never get tired of it, and I hear new things every single time I listen to it that I didn't quite listen before.
You feel like, it sounds like it makes you feel kind of like this, I don't know, almost maybe like a this is how good it gets, like, aspirational.
Yeah, I mean, just that, you know, we're all searching for that, and that's one thing we try to do every time we play, is just try to search for that magic and never really just sort of give in to that autopilot that, you know, because we've played these songs, as I'm sure Bill Evans played My Foolish Heart hundreds of times, but each time you just try to trick yourself into different ways of playing, whether it's subtle in arrangement or your part or just
it's
as a full
goosebumps, you know?
Yeah, goosebumps, just anything to just, like, keep it fresh and just to sort of, you know, make you excited, because if it's just
if it's all muscle memory, then it's just music for commercials. You know, you got to, like, the music that I love, whether it's jazz or metal or country or rock and roll, whatever, it's just, it's all about sort of achieving those moments that, you know, as a fan, when you go home, you want to, like, either write a song yourself or go, you know, run for Congress. I don't know. Yeah. But, you know, well, just that inspires you to.
And I think it's interesting that it's a live record that you're talking about, because there is something about, like, when you're playing live and you're trying to, like, basically get all your strings in sync with the other people. You know, like, if you believe in string theory, like, you want to be vibrating at the same frequency. You want to, like, capture some moment. And when you do, you can, like writing a song that you really like, you can black out. You know, like, you kind of, it's like, all of a sudden you're somewhere else and you're all together. And
Exactly. And that's why I love jazz. And even though jazz isn't really very popular, and I wouldn't call, you know, the Sons of Bill is definitely not a jazz band, but I think we kind of bring that jazz element where there's improvisation and there's just a high level of interaction where everybody's just really tuned in with each other. So we could react at a moment's notice if James does something different or if Todd breaks into a groove, just so every show is different and it makes it exciting. Sometimes you end up failing, but it's easier than just sort of, okay, we're going to play to a click track and do the same song the same way every night with the same set list.
Do you think it's easier because you're playing with your brothers? Like, that you guys kind of know each other on a deep, basic level?
Yeah, I mean, and just as a band, we've just been together, you know, we've been just doing it a long time and evolving and developing just a chemistry with these guys. I think it's just, you know, we've been doing it for a while.
There is a chemistry with your brothers and a trust, though, that I think, I mean, there's a reason why brothers bands have been around forever and probably always will be. Just getting each other on a deep level and then having that awareness and that trust on a real, and not just a musical trust, but like that trust and that love always translates into singing and into playing.
And even though we've played everything from metal to jazz, you know, and we did go and diversify so much as we got older, there's still that base of what we were hearing when we were so
right.
young.
You guys kind of have the same formative musical experiences,
that
there's always that
to fall back on.
Yeah. So. Cool. Well, you guys, thanks. I think the new record is really cool.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for the interview. I really appreciate
thanks
it.
So much.
Thanks
right
for
on.
Having
nice
us.
To meet you guys.
Nice
appreciate
to
it.
Meet you too.
Lighting up around 7th Street. And be sure to keep it way out of sight.
Big Unknown from Sons of Bill's record Love and Logic. And like I said before, I'm a fan of interviews that involve multiple band members, but I think this is the first time I've ever talked to members of a band who are also family members. And for me, it added an extra level of interest, an extra level of, like, band dynamic understanding. I mean, they're so connected, like from birth connected. And somewhere between tragedy and freedom and live connection, somewhere in there, that's where you find Sons of Bill. I'll post a link to the View House videos of the acoustic performances we captured backstage at Austin City Limits Festival. View House is a place where stations like KUTX and KCRW and KEXP put their best live videos. And I'm doing it so that you too can experience even more of Sons of Bill. And that's it. We have come to the end of another episode of This Song. This Song is a production of KUTX 98.9. This episode was produced and edited by Jack Anderson, David Sanger, and me, Elizabeth McQueen. The Zach Little interview was recorded by Cliff Hargrove, and the Sons of Bill interview was recorded by Jake Perlman. Thanks to Jackie Fuller for interviewing Zach. Jackie does many things at KUTX, including curating our Instagram feed. It's great. It's lovely. And I encourage you to follow KUTX on Instagram because she does a delightful job. You can hear Jack Anderson every Saturday night from 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. And thanks to Peter Babb and Deidre Gott for all their help on this podcast. And yes, It is true. Our theme song is Mahout by Austin's own excellent, hard-proof Afrobeat. You can email us at thissong@kutx.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or Snapchat. Our handle is @thissongKUTX. You can follow us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to This Song along with the other KUTX podcasts, Liner Notes, Song of the Day, and Austin Music Minute on iTunes. And like I said, we would love a rating or a review. Right on. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.